afternoon. My name is Ed Howard. I'm with the Alliance for Health Reform. And on behalf of our board of directors and Senator Rockefeller, I want to welcome you to this program to take a closer look at the current state of children's health, children's health care, children's health coverage in these times of government budget deficits and sluggish economic recovery. There's sort of a good news, bad news element in this story. We've made some great progress in lowering the number of kids without health insurance, even given the effects of the recession and the after effects. At the same time, we've had some challenges arise in the area of children's health. There's an explosion of obesity in children, for example, and a related rise in conditions like diabetes. And we're going to look at the good and the bad in today's discussion. And, of course, there are a number of provisions in the Affordable Care Act that will affect kids and their families, and we hope to learn a little more about those today as well. We're pleased to have as partner in today's program the Centene Corporation, which provides Medicaid coverage in almost a dozen states and operates a number of related services like nurse call centers. There are a number of posters about activities Centene's involved in around the room, and you're going to hear from their chief medical officer, Dr. Mary Mason, in a few minutes. A few logistical items before we get started. In your packets, there is obviously some very good information on this topic, including speaker biographical information, more extensive than I'm going to have time to give them. You'll also find the PowerPoint presentations so that you can follow along. There's a sheet in there saying materials list that has a number of other background materials, which is also online at our website, allhealth.org, so that you can get more information than we felt comfortable killing trees to give you directly this morning. There'll be a webcast and a podcast available probably tomorrow on kff.org, both that website and the service of having the webcast and podcast are as a result of the generosity of the Kaiser Family Foundation, for which we're very grateful. In a few days, you can see a transcript of this briefing on our website at allhealth.org, and you'll find in your packets green question cards that you can use at the appropriate time. There are some microphones. Oh, wait a second. Yes, there are some microphones you can use to ask questions orally as well. And there is a blue evaluation form in your packets that I'd appreciate it if you take the time to fill out so that we can help improve these programs for your future use. So let's get to the program. We have an extremely knowledgeable panel today with a very broad range of experience, and we'll follow their brief presentations with an extensive discussion and question and answer. So we're going to start with Jocelyn Geyer on my immediate right. She's the co-executive director at Georgetown's Center for Children and Families and a senior researcher at the Georgetown Health Policy Institute. And at the center, she's been studying how kids are affected by the health reform law, the reauthorization of CHIP, the role of Medicaid in covering families. She's been a senior staff member at the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities and the Kaiser Commission on Medicaid and the Uninsured. Also served a stint on Capitol Hill on the staff of Senator Moynihan at the appropriate time. And unless last-minute intervention has changed the schedule without my knowledge, I now turn to Jocelyn Geyer. Jocelyn, thanks for being with us.
Great. Thanks, Ed, and thanks so much for having this panel today. Thank you all for coming. It's a pretty remarkable time in children's coverage, and as Ed said, there's some great news to share, and then I think part of what we want to do today is outline some of the key challenges and where the new action is on children's coverage. To start with a bit of an overview, as Ed said, we've made remarkable progress on covering children, and I'm going to give you the hard data in a second. But I think that's perhaps the most important backdrop to this whole conversation, is that the country really has been moving forward in covering children in recent years. And so one of the challenges is as we move to new opportunities, implementing health reform, budget situations, how do we sustain and strengthen that coverage will be a key piece of what we need to look at. So far, states actually have been holding steady in their coverage of children, states who are so important in making decisions about Medicaid and CHIP. And I'm going to show you a little bit about where states are right now on coverage for kids in a couple of minutes. In terms of some of the big opportunities and challenges that I'm hoping to spend a little bit of time on today, the first is obviously that health reform implementation is moving apace. It's moving at different paces in different states, but it clearly is a major factor in shifting the landscape of coverage for children and also, frankly, their parents, which increasingly we're understanding and realizing that when we think about children's health, we really need to think about families as a unit. The state budget situation does continue to be a serious issue in a number of places, and I think Kathy from Alabama can probably speak to that quite directly, so we'll talk a little bit about that. And then coming right down the pike, perhaps as early as tomorrow, we're increasingly having a national dialogue about the future of the Medicaid program, which is a critical source of coverage for children. And what happens in that dialogue will be determinative of the next several years for children's coverage, if not longer. And then finally, the last theme I want to highlight, which in some ways really speaks to Centene's interest and commitment to kids, which is now that we've made some good progress with coverage, increasingly there's discussion about how do we move beyond coverage and make sure kids are really getting the high-quality care they need to manage their health conditions, make sure we're getting the health outcomes we want to go with health insurance coverage. So to go a little deeper on those themes, what this graph shows you is the trend over time in coverage of children. And what you can see, we went back only about 10 years. You could actually keep going back and you would get the same result, which is that last year and the year before, we were at the lowest level of uninsured rate for children since the Census Bureau started tracking this data. So it's really quite an achievement. Record levels of coverage among kids right now, it's about 90% of children have coverage. And I don't think any of us want to rest on our laurels. We still need to think about the remaining 10%. But again, as I said, as we move forward, we have to figure out how to sustain and strengthen what is a pretty remarkable set of improvements. Most of those gains can be directly attributed to states over the last several years expanding and strengthening their Medicaid program and their children's health insurance program. That's where the gains in coverage have come from. One interesting dynamic that isn't on this graph but that I can share with you, we did some research on how much of these gains are driven by Medicaid and how much are driven by the children's health insurance program, which people probably know is an important supplement and complement to Medicaid. And what we found is that while CHIP was critical in covering kids, it was increasing enrollment in Medicaid that actually drove 70% of the gains in covering children. So as we move forward, we need to keep an eye on both of these really important public programs for children. The next slide gives you a sense of how children are covered right now. And what you can see is that employer-based coverage, which is the red slice of the pie, remains the dominant source of children in this country. So employers continue to be the primary source for most children. But a very large slice, if you look at the green slice, that's the Medicaid and CHIP coverage. And you can see between Medicaid and CHIP, and for data reasons, there's some kids also on Medicare, a small number thrown into this slice. We're talking about close to a third of children in the country who are looking to Medicaid and CHIP for their affordable coverage options. And then the last slice is those children who remain uninsured, who we continue to need to figure out how to reach and find. One interesting thing, and the materials in your packet really address this in more detail than I can go into, is about two-thirds of these children are already eligible for Medicaid or CHIP. So we have a great opportunity to continue to make progress and to continue to reach those children and really move across the finish line in terms of getting coverage for all of our kids. And this slide is very similar, but it's a slightly different slice. It looks at low-income children in particular, who are the folks most amenable to policy changes because we are primarily covering them through Medicaid and CHIP. And you can see for them, it's really the public programs that we need to pay attention to and make sure that they're working well because that's the dominant source of coverage for low-income children. In terms of why we've made that progress on covering kids, this next map gives you a sense of where states are in their coverage levels of Medicaid, of children through Medicaid and CHIP. And I'm sure people know Medicaid and CHIP states have enormous flexibility to decide how far up the income scale they want to go, how many children they want to extend coverage to, as well as all sorts of flexibility on delivery system. This slide is really about where states are in their eligibility thresholds, and what you can see is that nearly all states cover children at least up to 200% of the federal poverty level. There's only four, and they're the ones that are in dark, so you can see which ones they are, that are a little bit below 200% of the poverty level. And also, interestingly, this year is the first year that it's now the norm that most states, or 25 states including D.C., cover children to 250% of the federal poverty line. And I think that's really reflecting the sense across the country in many states that families really need affordable coverage options, and Medicaid and CHIP in particular have worked very well to provide those options. Turning a little bit beyond coverage, I think it's important as we go into this conversation to have a sense of what are the key healthcare conditions affecting children. And this is something that has shifted dramatically over time. You know, when I was growing up, the generation before me, if you were to look at a chart like this, it really would have been some pretty scary diseases that would have been affecting children, polio, mumps, viruses that were very dangerous to children. And we've, again, to continue on the good news note, which is just our general style at Georgetown, we like to be upbeat, made tremendous progress in tackling some of those really scary diseases. And so now many of the issues for kids are shifting, and they're more about development. They're more about, we have more kids with serious disabilities, and they're consuming more and appropriately taking up more of our healthcare resources. We also see, if you look at this chart, the trend that I think has been much in the news and that Ed flagged at the beginning, which is the obesity epidemic. You can see that among children ages 12 to 19, we're up at close to 18% for school age, younger school age kids, 17.4%. And I think that's just the beginning of what look at the trends. Just to flag a couple of the other conditions on here, you can see the asthma and ADHD, and I think that's part of why, as you look at Centene's posters, much of it is focused on asthma and ADHD because those are very common conditions. I also want to flag for you the dental issue, which for children in particular, figuring out how to get them good dental care is really key, because what we find is that it is a particularly untreated situation. CMS has been working on it very assertively, but we still have an issue with untreated dental care. And that can really affect children in school. A lot of children are in some chronic pain from having untreated dental issues, so clearly an area where we need to continue to do more work. In terms of the key policy issues for kids, this is just kind of, I'm going to give you a smorgasbord, and I think we'll have time to dive into more of them throughout the discussion. Right now, first thing coming up in many places is implementation of the Affordable Care Act provisions, the short-term ones. There are a number that are aimed at protecting children and improving coverage for children. One is a ban on denying coverage to children with pre-existing conditions. You may have seen the news stories about this. It's gone well in some states. In other states, we've seen private insurers say, you know what, if we can't keep children out who are sick, we're going to pull out of the child-only market altogether, which certainly is a major issue for kids. So this has really come down to state leadership. In states where there's been strong leadership, California, Washington, Oregon, we've seen good progress. In other states, this change has actually created some challenges. Second early issue in the Affordable Care Act is what we call the stability protections. These are provisions that tell states they need to hold steady in their Medicaid and CHIP coverage of children, actually all the way through 2019. For adults, they need to hold steady through 2014. And I think it's these protections are a big part of why we have not seen in the last few years states scaling back on coverage for kids. A third issue is where we're going with a fairly early change in reimbursement rates for primary care and Medicaid, and hopefully we can talk more about that. Especially with Congressman Ryan's budget coming out tomorrow, I'd be remiss if I didn't flag the super obvious that we're going to be having lots of conversations about Medicaid, and the future of that program, as I said earlier, will be determinative. In terms of some of the longer-term issues, just to flag briefly for you, we're looking very closely when the Affordable Care Act is implemented in 2014, and adults are supposed to be in Medicaid along with children. We're going to have many families who have a split situation where kids are in Medicaid and CHIP and the parents are in potentially employer-based coverage. So we need to look at those transitions between Medicaid and CHIP and the exchanges very carefully for kids. As I said earlier, the delivery system changes. Increasingly, that's the focus now that we've made progress on coverage, and there's a number of provisions in the Affordable Care Act, and I'm sure Mary will cover them, that give us the chance to really change delivery systems for children. And then there are questions about the future of the CHIP program, as well as how we're going to succeed in getting coverage for parents as well as kids and families, and we can talk about all of those during the discussion.
Terrific. Thanks very much, Jocelyn. By the way, I want to thank Congressman McDermott for arranging the use of the Cannon Caucus Room. My first job on Capitol Hill was in an office in this building, which we always thought was the premier congressional office building. And this room reminds me of why I thought that. Somewhere I know what I'm going to say, and it's written down for me. Else I'm going to have to wing it. We're now going to hear from Vicki Wagino, who is the director of the Children and Adults Health Programs Group at the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services. That means she's in charge of CMS's work on eligibility and coverage for children and adults through Medicaid and the Children's Health Insurance Program. She oversees implementing the 2009 extension of CHIP and the preparations for some of the major Medicaid expansions that Jocelyn mentioned are coming in 2014. She has a whole lot of experience in the nonprofit world and spent 5 years at the Office of Management and Budget, so she's got a balanced view of the world from both sides of the fence. And we're very pleased to have you here today. Vicki?
Thank you. Do you want to pass it on? Oh, that's not. Thanks so much to the Alliance for having the briefing and for inviting me to participate today. It's great to be with you all. Jocelyn really set out the themes for my presentation very well, which is for kids' coverage, we start from a base of really tremendous success in improving coverage for kids. And going forward, it's really a question of how do we maintain that progress? How do we ensure that progress carries into strong delivery systems for our children? And also, how do we extend that progress to the new populations that are eligible under the Affordable Care Act? So I'm going to touch on all of those topics. But clearly, this is another way of showing you the data Jocelyn already showed you. Medicaid and CHIP have been working together for more than a decade to reduce the uninsurance rate of low-income uninsured kids. And I think that's a really appropriate starting point because all of us in this room who've worked on kids' coverage have a lot to be proud of. Going forward, though, we also know that there's more work to be done. Right now, there are 5 million eligible but unenrolled kids who are eligible for Medicaid and CHIP but have not yet enrolled. At CMS, we've done a lot of work with states to help address that problem. We awarded performance bonuses earlier this year to 15 states that had done a great job of enrolling eligible low-income children. And I'm happy to say that for the second year running, Alabama was leading the pack. And has showed really consistent leadership in that regard. We're also in the stages of awarding our second round of grants to organizations and states that develop new and successful ways of enrolling low-income uninsured kids. We released our request for applications in February and are looking forward to seeing our next round of grantees. Secretary Sebelius' leadership has been very key to our focus on covering kids, and she's announced Connecting Kids to Coverage Challenge, really challenging all of us who work on kids' coverage, whether it's states, provider organizations, community groups, to work together to enroll uninsured kids, and we've had more than 50 organizations step up and accept that challenge so far. Jocelyn showed you what the coverage pie looks like for kids now in Medicaid and CHIP. This is what it will look like for all populations in 2019 once the Affordable Care Act is fully implemented. And you'll see at that point Medicaid and CHIP will be the second largest source of coverage for all populations in the U.S. And really essential to our implementation work at CMS going forward is making sure that the component parts of the new healthcare system work together. We've seen in my earlier slide how Medicaid to cover low-income, uninsured kids. It's that same sense of success and of the different component parts working successfully together that we think will be essential to realizing the coverage goals as well as the cost and quality goals for the American healthcare system. This is what the world will look like in 2014. Medicaid will provide a strong base of coverage to low-income adults, with the exchange providing coverage to adults at higher income levels. Medicaid and CHIP will continue to work together to provide the strong base of coverage for kids. We focused our early efforts and implementation on ensuring that the system is seamless at the standpoint of when people come to enroll in coverage. People will come to Medicaid and CHIP in the exchange knowing in 2014 that they're eligible for something, but not necessarily knowing what program they're eligible for. In our work with states, we're prioritizing building systems that really help navigate people from the point of application, wherever it is that they apply, to the coverage that source that's appropriate for them. We released guidance to guide the development of these systems late last year, and the key principles for us are really that the system, the different components of the system have to be integrated and work well together. It's across Medicaid, CHIP, and the exchange. They have to provide a high degree of customer experience, and we know that today's consumer is used to operating in a real-time, computer-based environment, and that's very much the model that we envision moving forward with in 2014. And we also know from a long experience in Medicaid and CHIP that administrative burdens on families and people applying for coverage have the effect of discouraging people from applying. So our systems will ask only for the information that's really necessary in order to make an eligibility determination. Now, as you've heard, it's essential not only to enroll people well, but to really provide the strongest delivery systems and quality of care possible once people are enrolled. The Affordable Care Act gives us a variety of new tools in order to better manage quality, improve payment, and strengthen delivery system. I've highlighted some of them for you here. We also have been working very closely with states to help them meet the fiscal challenges that they are experiencing. And as Jocelyn noted earlier, how significant those are. We've been working with states to try to develop areas especially focused around improving purchasing of prescription drugs and ensuring program integrity in order to really help them address the fiscal challenges they face. We've developed state-based teams so that when states come to us with fiscal challenges, we have a cross-cutting team of people within CMS and within CMCS, the Center for Medicaid, CHIP, and Survey Certification, and bringing in people from the Innovation Center and the Duals office as well to really help the state identify and meet the challenges that it's facing. When we hear about the fiscal challenges states are facing, there's frequently a lot of focus on enrollment increases, particularly among kids and families. And that's exactly as you would expect in a recession where so many people are losing jobs and losing the health coverage that comes with it. The real cost drivers, both in the short and long term in the Medicaid program, though, are the needs of some very high-cost populations. And you'll see here that about 1% of the total Medicaid population accounts for 25% of the costs. Those are people with significant long-term care needs, with multiple chronic conditions. And so what we've been trying to focus on in our work as we work with states is really how do we get at the real cost drivers in the Medicaid program, and how do we to make the upfront investments and focus that's needed to really make costs manageable and improve quality of care over the long term. There's a lot of work that we're doing, particularly in this regard, helping states and providers reorganize the care delivery, improve care delivery, and improve quality of care. We were very fortunate in the Children's Health Insurance Program Reauthorization Act, which was signed in 2009, to have a lot of new focus on quality of care for children. So we've developed new quality measures that are child-specific that states are working on implementing now. We also awarded 10 demonstration grants to either individual states or states working together to try to address both the broader quality measures and get our new quality measures up and running on a pilot basis. But those grantees are also looking at conditions like obesity and asthma and oral health care and trying to develop improvements on those around those conditions that we can then help spread to other states as well. So I'll just close with basically where I started, which is that we've seen a lot of success and progress in children's coverage. And as Jocelyn said earlier, the question now is how do we keep maintaining that progress and also spread it to delivery systems, quality of care, and think about all of the new populations who will be eligible for Medicaid starting in 2014.
Terrific. Thanks very much, Vicki. Next, we're going to turn to Kathy Caldwell, who's the director of the Bureau of Children's Health Insurance. That's Alabama's CHIP program, and it's part of the Alabama Department of Public Health. She has had more than a dozen years of state government service with the Bureau, directing the statewide program known as All Kids. And I think it's worth noting that when the Alliance did its first program on the what was then the SCHIP program back in 1998, we had a speaker from Alabama to describe their exemplary, fast-out-of-the-box program. So it's only fitting to have a chance to have an update. Kathy, thanks for being with us.
Thank you. So I want to put a state face on some of what Jocelyn and Vicki have talked about. Let me tell you real quickly how the program in Alabama is structured. As Ed said, I actually work in the Alabama Department of Public Health, which is a separate state agency from the Alabama Medicaid agency. Our CHIP program is a standalone private insurance model, but we work very, very closely with the Alabama Medicaid agency. And our eligibility in our CHIP program goes up to 300% federal poverty level. And we deliver benefits through the Blue Cross and Blue Shield of Alabama network, which insures about 85% of the privately insured individuals in our state. So we have access to the entire Blue Cross network, including dental, which is a huge issue. And we also pay providers off of the Blue Cross preferred provider network, a fee schedule. So essentially our enrollees have a Blue Cross card like everybody else in Alabama, so you don't have some of the same stigma attached as you may with some public programs. And providers like us because we pay off the same fee schedule as all other Blue Cross plans. Let's see. This slide illustrates what both Vicki and Jocelyn talked about as far as Medicaid being the so much bigger than CHIP. CHIP is a very, very important program, particularly for middle-income families who, for a variety of reasons, just do not have insurance coverage on their children. But on this slide, you can see to the far left, prior to CHIP in Alabama, children enrolled in Medicaid, that number remained incredibly stable for a number of years. So after CHIP started, and with all of the encouragement we had to do outreach and to look like private insurance and everything, you can see that the number of children has steadily increased in Alabama Medicaid. The purple line is our CHIP program, which is called All Kids, and I'll use those terms interchangeable, but it's the exact same thing. Those other lines are the lighter line in between the two. So we had a Medicaid expansion component of CHIP early on, just for our adolescents who were not yet covered by Medicaid eligibility in Alabama, but that program has gone away. And we also had that very top line. We had a philanthropic program in place in Alabama until January 1 of this year. that would that cover children who were uninsured and not eligible for Medicaid or all kids. So that has left a gap. When all kids expanded it to 300% federal poverty level, it actually covered some of the children that were in that program, but that program was able to cover non-citizen children who have not yet met their five-year residency in this country. So that's leaving a big hole in Alabama right now. In addition, Blue Cross and Blue Shield of Alabama did stop child-only plans. So now for uninsured children who are not eligible for CHIP or Medicaid, there's a hole. But enrollment in our CHIP programs, over 75,000, and enrollment in our Medicaid program for children is over 400,000. So as you can see, a much, much larger program. We have always had the philosophy of designing our CHIP program in a family-friendly way. States do have a great amount of flexibility on how they set up their CHIP programs. We've always had a joint application with Medicaid. For several years now, we've had an electronic an online application as well as an electronic signature. So that has been great. We're really trying to market and promote greater use of the web-based application. In Alabama, we have premiums in our CHIP program, but they're annual premiums. We've recently done a study that shows that even the annual premiums do create some barriers to enrollment. We think that it's probably less than having monthly premiums, but our premiums are either $50 or $100 per year per child, with a max of either $300 a year per family or $150 per year per family. But even at those very nominal levels, that there's still a barrier. We do not require that the premium be paid at enrollment. The enrollee actually has 12 months to pay the premium. They cannot renew for the next year unless that premium is paid in full. And we do have 12 months of continuous eligibility unless the enrollee turns 19 prior to that point, prior to the end of the year. We do a lot of marketing and outreach. We have regional coordinators based around the state, and their presence is to just be the local presence to meet with the local providers and the PTAs and attend local health fairs, distribute applications. We'll send applications and posters and brochures to anybody that wants them. One other thing I want to point out, our CHIP program is a centralized processing system where Medicaid has outstationed eligibility workers around the state. But our CHIP regional coordinators work very closely with the Medicaid outstation workers, certainly from an outreach and education perspective. Like I said, we've always done a lot of outreach, media, you know, radio and TV and a lot of print media, and we do have staff around the state. A few years ago, there were several things going on. One, with the downturn in the economy, we saw more children being eligible for Medicaid and fewer being eligible for CHIP. Our CHIP enrollment was actually showing a slight decline. So both at new application and at renewal, we were referring more children to Medicaid than we had seen, a higher percentage actually than we had ever seen. So we began thinking, well, if family incomes are dropping and more children from the CHIP income range now Medicaid eligible, that's probably going on at the higher income level, and they'll be dropping into the CHIP income levels. And some of those families may have never encountered any public programs before. So maybe a job loss by one of the parents, possibly loss of insurance with that. And so now the children uninsured and families possibly not knowing what's available. In addition to that, the Alabama legislature appropriated funds for us to expand eligibility to 300% federal poverty level. So we were really in a mindset of, we needed to come up with some outreach strategies that possibly focused on a little bit higher income family than we had previously been focusing on. And so these are some of the new strategies that we've initiated. The biggest one is our collegiate sports marketing. We've partnered with four Alabama universities, the University of Alabama, Auburn University, Troy, and University of Alabama at Birmingham, and huge sports presence. You know, with Alabama and Auburn, you know, we've had a little bit of success lately in football, and so we have on-field presence, you know, 100,000-plus attendees at all of the home games. We have booths set up to give out information, you know, the LED signage and scoreboard. But in addition, we have spots on all of the coaches' shows and, you know, on their websites and in the program. So certainly there are a lot of middle-income families in the stands, but it's also being blasted out around the state with spots with the head football and basketball coaches. So that's been very, very successful. Certainly increases in some of our other media as well as more web presence on the homepage of the Alabama Department of Public Health, which is where our web-based application is housed. Want to touch on some of the successes in Alabama. Alabama's uninsurance rate for children is 6.8%. which isn't as wonderful as some states, but that's really good for Alabama. Prior to CHIP, it was over 15%. So we're very proud of that. We certainly still have uninsured children in our state. Last estimate, about 81,000. So we still have a lot of work to do. The vast majority of those are eligible for CHIP and Medicaid, just not enrolled. We've also recently done a study looking at our enrollees with asthma, and we have seen a reduction in hospitalizations and ED visits when we compared the first year of enrollment to the second and third year of enrollment. So we're so proud of that, because one question we've always wanted to answer is, being enrolled in our program, is that actually improving the health of our enrollees? So we think we're doing a great job in that area. But like I said, still have a lot of work to do. We're moving forward with healthcare reform activities, CHIP, Medicaid, insurance department, private insurers. We think we have some pieces already built in our state, like some of the integration between CHIP and Medicaid and interfacing with private insurance. So we're moving forward with putting the pieces together. And another huge issue is we're trying to make everybody realize that children's needs are different than adults. So as we move forward with healthcare reform, that has to be understood. And so we're certainly trying to be a voice for that as well.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Finally, we're going to hear from Dr. Mary Mason, Chief Medical Officer and Senior Vice President for the Centene Corporation. As I mentioned, Centene provides Medicaid coverage for about 1.5 million folks in a dozen states. Now, the company names differ from state to state, and none of them is Centene, so you're forgiven if you're not familiar, at least at this point, with them. Dr. Mason is an internist. She's created a number of medical management programs for Centene, including the Start Smart for Your Baby, the pregnancy and newborn program that I hope get more information from in the booklet that was available at the registration desk. Dr. Mason, thank you for being with us this morning.
Thank you so much. I'm very happy to be here. You know, as Ahmed said, Centene is a multi-line healthcare company. We specialize in the underinsured and uninsured, and most of those patients are under Medicaid, in all lines of Medicaid. So TANF, SCHIP, ABD, or Age, Blind, and Disabled, the SSI, long-term care, as well as foster care. And when, as you see, our names are local, because we believe healthcare is local, and we really have a very strong local presence. In addition to our health plans, we also have, we also manage and own specialty companies. And this helps us to be creative and have an integrated approach and solution when we go to states to come up with a full package where we can bring programs that have better quality outcomes at lower cost. About 1.5 million members, and about 72% or a little over a million are under the age of 18. We also have about 60,000 pregnancies per year. And this is very important when you're creating innovative clinical programs that really impact members, because it's not cookie cutter. You really have to play to the audience, especially when you look at how social media plays in and how people take in information. A 20-year-old pregnant woman is much different than a 40-year-old pregnant woman. Our goals, our mission, better health outcomes at lower cost. And when you think about the importance of the medical home, a child with asthma, we want them establishing a very strong relationship with their primary care doctor. We don't want them in the emergency room. So we have a very strong focus on identifying those children early who are at high risk and getting them into a pediatrician and then reinforcing that relationship. So let's talk a little bit about the issues that are facing children today. We've talked about obesity, and we all know the trends. One of the things that we found when we were developing our childhood obesity prevention program is there was a true lack of materials out there that engaged children, were culturally sensitive, as well as had a whole health literacy component to it. So we decided to develop our own, and we partnered with a children's author to develop books for children age 4 to 9. We also developed an accompanying parent guide as well, and this is our Adventures Through Fitropolis that you can see. What we do is we go into schools. So we go where the children are, we bring in the children's author, we have an interactive school assembly, every child goes home with a book as well as one for their parent. We also have a cookbook here, and this was the result of a nationwide healthy after-school snack program that we had, and we put the book together, and we distribute that through our schools as well. We've also worked with community organizations. The Girl Scouts has been a wonderful group to work with. We developed a pilot program with the Girl Scout Council in Eastern Missouri. We took our book, and we turned it into a brownie badge. So for second and third graders, piloted in our schools, and now we just moved into 100 troops in Atlanta that are going to be doing the program now. And as far as results, we measured fund of knowledge about nutrition and exercise initiatives. And you can see from pre-test to post-test, we have a statistically significant difference. Asthma, another major disease that we deal with every day. And working with our disease management company, Nurture, we have a very proactive disease management program that also involves case management and care coordination. And this was a subset of about 4,000 children. And when we looked at the data to see how the participants did versus the non-participants, you can see a 17.3% decrease in ER visits, as well as an 11% increase in primary care visits. And as a note, we had about a 23% increase in children who had asthma who were getting influenza vaccinations. So really a great success. And taking off on the children's book series and theme, we created another book series for asthma, and this is Adventures in Puffletown. And we take these the characters take these children through dealing with their asthma, how to be compliant, how to take care of themselves. Also have the children's book as well as a DVD. RSV, respiratory illness, very common, especially in the first 2 years of life. However, certain high-risk infants, especially those born to the NICU, can have some serious complications, including respiratory distress, ending up on a ventilator, ending up in the ICU. We have a very proactive, comprehensive program where we identify those children who are at high risk, We reach out to them. We see if they are appropriate candidates for a medication called Synagis, which helps to immunize them against RSV. And then we work with care coordination techniques to make sure that those children are being compliant with the multi-dose treatment. If you see here, we've actually decreased our average length of stay for these children if they are admitted back to the hospital. We also have a 96% compliance rate with a multiple dose injection, and our program has helped to save over $8 million in 2010. Start Smart for Your Baby is our comprehensive prenatal and postpartum program because it all begins with a healthy baby if you want a healthy child. We manage about 60,000 pregnancies per year. And our program is multifaceted. We actually have a combination of case management, disease management, as well as wellness and care coordination. And we extend it through the first 2 years of life because many of the mothers will lose their eligibility 6 to 8 weeks postpartum because they are no longer pregnant, no longer on Medicaid, but the children are still on our plan. And we want to take that opportunity during pregnancy to form a very solid relationship with that woman to make sure that when the child needs care, we can make it work through her to make sure that that child is getting in for their preventive visits. This is some examples of the materials we have developed with a health literacy firm. Once again, we work to make sure that these books truly speak to the Medicaid population. How do you create a low-cost, healthy meal using WIC foods for a pregnant woman? Those type of issues we address in these books. The book on the left is endorsed by the March of Dimes. The one that you should have in your hand that was outside, we just co-wrote with the American Academy of Pediatrics. And really focuses on important issues the mother may face, including affordable parenting. Identification is so key, and we call the ticket to our program the notification of pregnancy. This is a streamlined form that gathers a bit of extra information that we need in order to figure out, is this woman high risk or not? And this is information we can't get from claims data or eligibility information that the state gives us. We take that information, we put it through proprietary risk scoring, and then we are able to figure out, does the woman need high-risk case management, does she need disease management, or just straight education? This is going to be published this month in the peer review section of Managed Care. And what you can see is that for those women who had a notification of pregnancy versus those who did not, if you look at the birth outcomes, the women who had a notification of pregnancy enrolled in our program, a 31% decrease in babies under 1,000 grams. And keep in mind, these are the most expensive babies for the healthcare system. We saw a 20% decrease in 1,500 grams, as well as almost an 8% in under 2,500 grams. And if you look also at other health outcomes, including NICU days per 1,000 births, we've gone from 575 down to 400 NICU days per 1,000 births, as well as increase the gestational weight of these babies. This has resulted in a $14 million savings for these women in 2010. The cost is about $75 per pregnancy. 17P, this is 17-alpha-hydroxyprogesterone, steroid injection to help prevent premature birth in those women who have had previous premature birth, has been a bit in the news recently. We've been using this in working with the ACOG endorsement to get this out to women who are appropriate candidates. And we have a very customized hybrid reporting system where we can figure out who is an appropriate candidate. This is actually from a published paper we had last year of our five-year experience, a 30% decrease in babies born who ended up in the NICU versus those women in the control group. So, pregnancy and smoking. Obviously, smoking is one of the modifiable risk factors for premature birth. Working with our disease management company, have come up with a comprehensive program, including health coaching, and we've seen some very good outcomes there as well. And let's not forget about teenagers. They are probably some of the hardest groups to reach. We actually developed a book series for teens working with case managers as well as experts in behavioral health, to give them a lifestyle guide that includes taking care of themselves and having healthy habits. This book is actually now being extended into different disease states. We want to have one coming out in asthma next year. So in conclusion, you can see there is a wide variety of health issues we deal with. We try to apply sound clinical principles and innovation, and we continue to see better outcomes at lower cost. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Dr. Mason. And now we get a chance to hear from you. If you have questions, you can either write them on that green card in your packets and hold them up, or come to one of the microphones that you see in the front left and right of the room. If you do that, we'd appreciate it if you'd identify yourself, keep your question as quick as brief as you can, and direct it to a panelist if that's appropriate. And we have someone standing at the microphone. Go right ahead.
Hi. Thank you for taking my question. I'm Megan McCarthy with National Journal. Obviously, Jocelyn talked about the budget plan that's supposed to be released tomorrow, and there's talk about block granting Medicaid. So I was wondering if the panel could talk about how that would impact children's coverage.
I will say, by the way, obviously this is a matter of great interest and will have an impact on kids and everybody else. We would like to try to focus on those aspects of this that will have a direct impact on kids or vice versa. Having said that, is there anybody on the panel who would like to volunteer a reaction to something that hasn't come out yet? Except on the Sunday talk shows.
I can volunteer a reaction in the sense of I think it is an issue that's centrally important to children's coverage. What we do with the Medicaid program, the level of funding, the structure of the financing mechanism for Medicaid is key to determining what happens with children's coverage over the next several years, and that's because of very basic math. We're talking about more than one in four kids in our country looking to Medicaid for health insurance. They're more than half of the people enrolled in Medicaid, so they're a key part of what happens. The other thing I would say is even looking beyond just the basics of how many children look to Medicaid, I think we also need to take the next level down and look at who are the children that use Medicaid. Many are children in low and moderate income working families looking for help with pretty routine childhood conditions, asthma, dental issues. But there also is a very important subset of the children on Medicaid who have extremely serious healthcare conditions. It's the primary source of coverage for children with special healthcare needs. It pays for half of all NICU stays. So what happens with Medicaid affects enormous numbers of kids, and it also affects the most vulnerable children in America.
Anybody else? Picking up on the theme of what gets spent on Medicaid, I wanted to follow up with Dr. Mason on one aspect of what you were describing. We read in a long article in the Saturday New York Times about sort of chronicling all of the states that are cutting back in the reimbursement rates that are being paid to providers, and presumably in a managed care sense to insurers as well. Do you have to make these programs not only good for clinical results, but in every instance saving total spending so that you can afford to continue these programs?
You know, Ed, that is a great question. You know, obviously, you know, we are stewards of the taxpayers' money. So we are responsible when we work with a state to make sure that we are providing high-quality care and that we are providing cost savings. I will also tell you, as a physician, good quality medicine executed on saves money. And so much of what we do is care coordination, of making sure the transportation is there, making sure that patients are compliant with their medications, that they have their medications to take. So, and also the other key part is early identification and using systems that we put in place figuring out early on who needs attention and then acting on it and getting them the right level of care. So you can have a very robust program. You need to put some money into it in the beginning, but it can absolutely achieve cost savings in the end.
Okay. Can I just ask, maybe Vicki can comment on this as well. The central point in a lot of this discussion, and certainly in the piece in the Times, was that the cuts in reimbursement were harming access, not necessarily for kids, but certainly for kids among others. And I wonder what your perception is of whether that is more widespread, whether it's going to get worse, what you can do about it at the national level.
I think we're fortunate to have some new tools to look at access really closely. I think the MACPAC, the new Medicaid and CHIP Access Commission, is looking really carefully at access issues in our programs, and we really welcome their focus and analytics and leadership, because I think they're going to help flesh out, and their first report did come out, exactly the extent of the access problems, the extent to which they're widespread versus concentrated in some regions or some subspecialties. And I think we'll be looking very closely at their analysis and recommendations to see how we can work with states to ensure that access is as strong as it can be.
And can I pick up on that, Ed? Because I also wanted to make a little bit of anyone who's looking at access issues, I highly recommend that you look at the MACPAC report, because it, unlike what you can do in a newspaper article, it really goes into some depth about where we're doing extremely well in some respects. For example, if you look at having a usual source of care, Medicaid is excellent at getting kids a usual source of care. It does as well as private insurance. It's 5 times better than not having insurance. But it also looks at where there are some issues, and the one that jumps out in the MACPAC report is specialty care. And so I think in the years ahead, as we look at implementing health reform, as we look at delivery system reform, that's a useful area to target. But I would hate for people to leave. I mean, I think in some ways the New York Times article, they were flagging a hot spot, but I think it's really important that people have the overall context, which is, in general, Medicaid has been extraordinarily effective at securing access to care for kids, and we want to look at where those issues are and target them and make sure they don't get worse with the budget situation, but I think it's really important that people have that overall context about its strong points when it comes to access to care for kids.
Yes, go right ahead.
Hi, I'm Bob Hall with the American Academy of Pediatrics, and perhaps two questions to Dr. Mason or whoever would like to answer. First one is something that Kathy Caldwell mentioned. The kid-only plans, leaving states as a result of the pre-existing condition exclusion. There's so much flexibility that's been given to insurers to really allow them. They can have open enrollment periods. They can do so many. They can raise. You know, there's a lot of flexibility. Why are insurers still leaving? And how do we solve that fundamental problem of getting these kids who have a diagnosed illness some level of coverage? The second one is also perhaps from the insurance perspective. One of the unique benefits that kids get in Medicaid is EPSD3, early and periodic screening, diagnosis, and treatment. What would it mean from an insurance perspective if Medicaid were to be block granted and kids might lose perhaps some of those sort of more open-ended or appropriate pediatric benefits?
All right. Well, first of all, to answer your first question, you know, as a managed Medicaid plan, we get all comers. And so I really can't answer for commercial on the coverage issue, but what we do is when we get that pool, we quickly start sorting through the patient's claims, health risk assessments, trying to figure out the right level of care. Now, as far as EPSDT, and you cut out just a little bit on me on the end, you wanted to know more about the coverage changes with the EPSDT?
Well, what if Medicaid was block granted? States had the ability to do what they wanted to with Medicaid dollars and perhaps try to apply adult services to what kids need.
Right. And, you know, I think it's the same thing, you know, as what I said before. Good medicine is good medicine. And, you know, we have a program, EPSDT. It is, you know, our report card for the states to make sure that we are providing high-quality care. But I think so much in the end of whether it's a HEDIS measure, not a HEDIS measure, EPSDT, not EPSDT, we need to do the right things. And that's really what we try to do. You know, working with professional organizations like yourself from the American Academy of Pediatrics, of working through, you know, the evidence-based medicine clinical pathways and really promoting that with our providers and collaborating with them to make sure the kids get the services that they need.
Yes.
Jessica Zygmunt with Modern Healthcare Magazine. A few of you have mentioned if these improvements in access have actually resulted in effective care for kids. Can you tell me if you've started tracking that, and if so, how?
Well, that's a very broad question. you know, I think we have a variety of data sources that really show the improvements in access. Jocelyn referred to the MACPAC report and showing things like usual source of care and kids who receive a primary care visit over the course of the year. You know, in looking at it, we look at our own data, but also external survey data like the National Health Interview Survey and looking at some of the broader data sources. So I'm not sure if that answers your question or if anyone else wants to try to answer it as well.
Kathy?
We're trying to look at that. We have seen since early on in the program that access to care is greatly increased when an uninsured child is enrolled in our CHIP program. So we have many years of data to show that. What's a little bit harder to show is, are the children healthier because of that enrollment? And I mentioned we've just looked at our enrollees with asthma, and we have seen that, yes, in fact, utilization on the things you don't want to see, like hospitalizations and emergency department visits, have gone down, costs have gone down, but utilization of appropriate medications has gone up. We're also looking at ambulatory sensitive conditions. Are they reduced over time in enrollment? So we're trying to look at more of the outcomes. Right now it's just a little bit harder to get at in the access.
And I would just add, it's one of the wonderful things about the MACPAC report is they do go through what the current data sources are that are available. And so there's the kind of thing I mentioned, but there is also some clinical measures in some of the surveys. So for example, we do have information on dental visits across private, uninsured, Medicaid, and we can see Medicaid having a positive effect there, not as strong as private, but having an effect. They have measures like, is the family being counseled on smoking? So we do have some national surveys that pick that up. I think part of the point of MACPAC is we obviously need more, and one of the things that they do is outline an agenda for getting to a place where we really have good, even stronger answers to your kinds of questions.
I should also add, because I forgot to mention it earlier, is our quality measures program for kids, which, as I mentioned during my presentation, is really just getting underway. States are looking at the measures and reporting now. It's a voluntary program that was created under CHIPRA, and we established a set of core measures that look at things like access to prenatal care, the percentage of kids who are getting a well child visit in their first 15 months, the rate of access to oral health care. So it's part of a significant strengthening of data collection on our part with states and getting more consistency state to state in what's reported and measured so that we can really measure and manage outcomes.
Vicki, you mentioned in one of your slides in connection with quality that disparities were narrowing, racial and ethnic disparities in care. And I wonder if you could elaborate a little about that, because we've been wrestling with that in the rest of the healthcare system as well. And
sure.
The new HRQ report doesn't look all that encouraging from the standpoint of year-to-year improvement.
Uh-huh. Yeah, I do think that that Medicaid and CHIP have played a really vital role because of the populations that they serve in improving disparities, you know, especially around primary care and usual source of care, you know, relative to the alternative of being uninsured. But I think to really have a robust program to address health disparities nationally, you know, Medicaid and CHIP need to play a really big role in ensuring that people have access to the care that they need.
I've got a question, pardon me, question from one of the congressional staff in the audience. What's your reaction to the McKenna drug, and I assume that's the 17P drug that Dr. Mason was talking about. What's your reaction to that price being lowered and the announcement by FDA they wouldn't go after compounding pharmacies producing the compound at lower cost? Is this something that may have a great effect on Medicaid and CHIP costs and access to the drug and on health and birth outcomes?
Well, first of all, you know, 17P is an old drug. There was a landmark study back in 2003 in the New England Journal that showed the potential to use this in an OB population. These women who have had previous premature birth are very, very high risk of having a subsequent premature birth. So we, ACOG came out, American College of OBGYN, and endorsed this drug, even though it didn't have an FDA approval, and then reaffirmed it in 2008. And, you know, taking that guidance from, you know, the leaders in the OB community, we've been very active in identifying women who are potential candidates for 17P and working with their physicians to see if they are appropriate candidates, then helping to coordinate this multi-dose therapy, because often you start it at 16 weeks gestation in the pregnancy, and it goes through 36 weeks, so you're talking about 20 shots. $20 was the price of this being compounded per injection, and then the price tag came out at $1,500 per injection, so you can do the math. And we have about, just so you know, we have about 1,000 women every year that we have on 17P, so we have quite a bit of experience with this. What I would say about watching all these events is that I think this really was a win in the end. We have continually showed year after year that 17P helps to reduce NICU admissions and premature births in these women. And as my slide showed you, a 30% decrease. And now people know what 17P is. And now it's available again since the FDA made the announcement that it would not be going after compounding pharmacies. We have it at $20 a dose again. So I applaud the FDA. I applaud, the March of Dimes, all the organizations that came out, ACOG, AAP, Society of Maternal Fetal Medicine, and saying this wasn't right with the price tag being $1,500 a dose. So I think, if anything, it's a win at the end of the day.
I would just add to that, the other thing that struck me about this whole incident, and I don't know much about the clinical side, is it's a perfect example of how Medicaid reform only happens as part of broader healthcare system reform. A Medicaid managed care company can be doing an amazing job shortening NICU stays, preventing preterm labor, and then get nailed with a price increase like this. And if we haven't dealt with the factors that are driving these external random shots to healthcare inflation, then it leaves Medicaid is doing all that it can, and if we don't support changes in the broader healthcare system, it's going to be really hard to continue to keep Medicaid as effective and efficient a program as it is.
Yes, sir.
Hi, my name is Raphael Szymanski from University of Pennsylvania. I wanted to shift the focus to the second item of care and wanted to kind of ask, I think, Jocelyn mentioned issues around access to specialty care, and I guess I would include issues around quality of specialty care. And two of the populations that I work with, children with mental health issues and children with autism, I think there's a lot of issues around access and also quality, particularly since Medicaid, I think, plays a lot larger role in the kind of services these children get, especially community-based services and long-term care. And I'd be very interested in hearing from Mary and Kathy, as well as the other speakers, about kind of what they see the plan role in terms of focusing on maybe slightly smaller but special needs populations than, say, the asthma and obesity, in terms of really focusing on improving the quality of the services, and what does it mean if there may not be as great cost offsets as for other conditions? I think we haven't really found the huge cost offsets, I know, for mental health. I'm not sure what the research says about autism. And I'd be interested from a state perspective, kind of what you see the state role in kind of working on these issues, especially something like autism, which is such an emerging group. Thank you.
And we do have someone who submitted a question on green card asking in general about mental illness and the services from place to place under Medicaid and SCHIP for kids.
Do you want to go first?
I'll go first. I'll talk about how we're handling that in a separate program. A lot of this may not apply to Medicaid, though. We do partner with Blue Cross and Blue Shield of Alabama, so we have access to their entire networks, dental, mental health, all of their specialty networks. And then wherever possible, we have supplemented those networks. For example, we've added all the community mental health centers to the private mental health network in place with Blue Cross. We've added all of the children's rehabilitation, which is the Title V clinics. We've added all of those to our network. So with our standalone CHIP program, we have made every effort to add every provider in the state who treats children, and particularly any of the specialists. We still have a problem because there aren't enough specialists in some areas. For example, pediatric dentists. Even though we have access to the largest network there is in our state, there aren't enough pediatric dentists. And then some of those aren't in any networks. On mental health, I think we've done a great job, and particularly with mental health parity, essentially our benefit is unlimited now. The issues are a little bit different with Medicaid. So certainly if we have issues with there's just simply not being enough providers in the state, when you take a program that doesn't even have all of them, it is a huge issue. And I wanted to tie that in a little bit to EPSDT and our standalone CHIP. We don't have EPSDT, but when we look at our enrollees with special health care needs, we've always seen that we overwhelmingly provide most of the services they need. I mean, obviously there are some children that need a little bit above and beyond that, but we've done that by partnering with some other state agencies and making sure we do have all the safety net providers as well as all the specialists in our network that we possibly can have.
An approach that we have taken is that it's very hard to separate mental health from the physical health. You really have to approach it as a very integrated model. And we have one of our specialty companies is Simpatico, which is behavioral health. And what we have found to be very successful is we co-locate our behavioral health care managers with our pediatric and our medical case managers. Often we'll put we put them into pods and we'll put them, you know, right next to each other. They're working on the same plan, so it's an integrated care plan addressing both the medical needs and the behavioral health needs. This works well for autism, it works well for schizophrenia, it works well for depression. So that's the way that we have approached it, and we really find that to be very successful.
Okay. We have several of the panelists mentioned the fact that there are large numbers of children who are eligible but unenrolled in either Medicaid and CHIP. I wonder that those calculations are usually done by looking at family income compared to eligibility levels, as I understand it, correct me if I'm wrong. And that raises the question, whether of those 5 million, some significant percentage are not going to be eligible because they are undocumented, or for other reasons that would make them ineligible other than the income level. And I don't know whether anybody has really looked at that.
Yeah, we've looked closely at those studies, and the good news is that they do actually take into account immigration status, and they look at if a child is undocumented or, Kathy was mentioning the five-year bar, even if they're here illegally, they still in most states can't get Medicaid and CHIP. They're not eligible for their first 5 years in the country. And the work that the Urban Institute has done does take that into account. So we're seeing a genuine, these really are the kids we could be signing up for coverage. They're eligible based on income, and they're eligible because they're citizens or legal immigrants who have been here for more than 5 years.
So the 5 million is a pretty solid number.
It's a solid, yep. They've done very careful scrubbing on that.
And we've seen the exact same thing in Alabama. And it's not like it's one finite pot of children that if we could only go find them and get them enrolled. It's the whole notion that they change from status, and so they may be enrolled in Medicaid for a year and then drop off for a few months, and then may go back on Medicaid or may become CHIP eligible, or family income may increase and private insurance available, so they may be privately insured. So it's the whole turning effect in the family situations changing, so it's a different group of kids going in and out of that uninsured market. But that's certainly why we've continued to do a large amount of outreach always, because it is such a moving target.
And we do know from experience in states like Alabama that this churning effect of people losing coverage only to come back on a short while later, which strongly suggests that the people were eligible all along and just fell off of coverage, is a significant problem. And it's one reason that in our most recent round of enrollment and outreach grants, we put one of our focus areas is really on streamlining the renewal process and making it easier for families who continue to be eligible to maintain their coverage for children, which is essential not just from an eligibility standpoint, but really supporting all of the quality and care management goals that we've all talked about. You have to have the child continuously enrolled in a health plan in order for us to manage the care of the child.
And a little commercial, the Alliance is planning a program looking specifically at coverage and churning issues sometime in the next month or so. So stay tuned for that. The questioner writes, as the economy improves, but employers do not reinstate benefits that were cut, do you expect there to be a growth in uninsurance in kids' population? And in a way, this question really goes to the vitality of the Medicaid and CHIP enterprise in general, since that's been what has kept coverage levels high and growing in the face of a very big recession. Can you keep it up?
I think that's exactly right, Ed. The reason why we've had this remarkable success in covering kids, which is particularly notable in light of the downturn, is because Medicaid and CHIP have been strong, and they've held strong throughout the recession, in part because of states' commitments and in part because there's very specific provisions in both the Recovery Act and the Affordable Care Act requiring states to continue coverage. I think over the next couple of years, the name of the game is going to be what happens with federal support for Medicaid. And if we do see anything like the rumored levels of cuts that was on the weekend news shows, I think we could very quickly unravel the success we've had in covering kids. So I think that will be determinative as we go forward.
Let me just ask you in these last few minutes we have here, if you would take the time to fill out that blue evaluation form so that we can improve the programs as we go forward. I've got a question for Kathy. As you described it, the All Kids program is a separate program run basically as a private insurance plan. Maybe you could talk a little about the problems, if there are problems, in coordinating currently with Medicaid and in prospect with Medicaid and operations within an exchange, if there is one operating in Alabama, and how you make those handoffs in a seamless way.
Okay. And certainly there are some problems with the fact that we have two separate programs and separate state agencies, and in some cases different networks and some providers in one network and not in the other. In Alabama, there's good and valid reasons for it being a separate program, and we're very proud of our CHIP program, and actually it has brought about some tremendous improvements in the Medicaid program for children. But coordination is still an issue. We have always had a joint application, and through some Robert Wood Johnson Foundation grant initiatives, we have built an automated data integration system where we send data electronically between the two agencies. An application can come in through either door, and the information is exchanged. So the family doesn't have to figure all this out. Just uninsured children apply online. The data are automatically routed to the appropriate agency. If it's a paper application, we we'll screen it and then route the data electronically to the other agency. We have aligned our eligibility so that there will be no children who drop through the cracks, such as income disregards early in CHIP. We didn't have them, and Medicaid did, and we found that there were some children who might not be eligible for either program, or actually might be eligible for both, depending on who processed the application first. So we overcame that. We make sure to check each other's system to, upon enrollment, to make sure there's no there are no children that end up in both programs. We make sure to align effective dates so that if a child is transitioning from one program to the other, the new coverage begins the day after the old one ends. And so we work very, very hard to coordinate. But there are families that will call and say, you know, I got used to one doctor and now they're not in the other one's network. So we continue to work on that. Because of eligibility levels being different depending on the age of the child, there may be families that have children in both programs. So there are certainly some barriers, but we work real hard to overcome those, and we work real hard to make sure our staff are well educated on the other programs so that they can help facilitate that as well.
Cindy, do you hear a lot of similar kinds of problems in other states where there are private Medicaid hybrids or private only operations?
Yes, Vicki. People get me to do that all the time.
Excuse me.
That's okay. It's always good to be mistaken for your boss. Yes, I think the coordination issues across Medicaid and CHIP were really key in making sure that to the extent possible that plans can support, you know, members of the same family and ensure continuity of care, as Kathy's described. I think it'll also be an issue going forward with ACA implementation, really making sure that plans are available to serve children and families, even though they may be in different sources of coverage. So I think we have a lot to learn from states like Alabama that have been helping families navigate that for a long time now.
Very good. Mm-hmm. Panelists have final words to share with our audience? Last chance. If not, let me just take this opportunity to thank our friends at Centene for their sponsorship and direct contribution to the level of the discussion today. Thank you for being interested in an important topic, but having to deal with the fact that it's 80 degrees and nice outside. And I'd ask you to help me thank the panel for a very useful discussion on a very important topic.